Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 179, and the prophet Mlanjeni is about to emerge. His story is one of the phenomenal tales of our land. He joined an already fairly long list of colonial era fighters who imbued their struggle against encroaching settlers with a combination of Christian salvation ethos and a narrative full of amaxhosa, ancient mystery and magic. Last episode, we heard how Mlanjeni had been calling all local spiritual leaders to his home where they were to pass between two poles and be cleansed and purified. After this, other rank-and-file amaxhosa were being called to be cleansed by Mlanjeni from his village amongst the Mhlambe people, a people who were now being administered by Commissioner John McLean. John McLean had written a brief message to Governor Harry Smith about the rising excitement amongst the amaxhosa about Mlanjeni's prophecies. It was a messianic paradigm, eventually morphing into a story about the triumphant resurrection of the ancestors who were going to drive the English back into the sea. Part of that message has been repeated ever since. So let's take a much closer look at Prophet Mlanjeni. What made him tick? By the time he was a youth of 18, he had begun to fast regularly in the manner of all other messianic messengers like Moses or Muhammad, a process guaranteed to lead to hallucination. Without going too far into the weeds here, those who go on hunger strike or fast extensively report there is an incredible psychological impact. Fasting beyond 72 hours, for example, causes a deficiency in nutrients. Muscles begin to break down. Dizziness and dehydration occur. As the prophet continues to fast, hallucinations can be extreme. Electrolyte imbalances trigger brain malfunction, leading to delirium. It was in this delirious state that Mlanjeni found his happy place. And as psychologists will tell you, those with pre-existing mental conditions should not fast beyond what is accepted as healthy. When Mlanjeni called his people to the two poles for cleansing, he could barely walk. He was so frail from his fastidious fasting. It was the 18th of August, 1850, when McLean first heard about this war doctor, who at this point merely appeared to be a somewhat misguided youngster with pre-existing mental conditions. Mlanjeni, like the previous war doctor Ngwele, had lived in the Cape Colony and heard the messages of Christianity and Islam. When he returned to the Mhlambe people living near the Amatola Mountains, people say he changed. His family said he took to sitting in a nearby river in the still waters of a pool, sitting there in water up to his neck, musing on the world, refusing to eat. He said he was talking to the spirit world, to his ancestors, and was infused with divine powers, endowed with the capacity to relay the messages from the ancients to the amaxhosa. He was told he had to purify his people, and the way he was going to do this was similar to what war doctor Ngwele, also known as Makanya, had done. The new prophet believed that the practice of smelling out witches was an evil, and at first glance he seemed to parrot what Harry Smith was trying to enforce, an eradication of the belief patterns based on the dark arts, witchcraft. Instead of pretending to be a traditional healer, he spoke of discarding the ubuti, or bewitching materials, across the countryside, which put him in direct conflict with these healers who used the ubuti to treat a supposedly bewitched person. Incantations and charms and bracelets and potions, and the keeping of baboons by these traditional healers. Baboons were associated with the dark practices and used to ward off the evil spirits. Mlanjeni said instead of treating himself with these things, the people should head off to his home and merely pass between the two poles, and thus be purified. He said the ubuti was the root cause of all amaxhosa suffering, linked to disease and death, and he declared, "Let us cast it away, and come to me to be cleansed." Normally a grandiose claim of this sort from a troubled youth would have been ignored, but the amaxhosa across the Cape were ripe and ready for such a message. Their leaders had failed them, the traditional ways had failed them, and here was a messiah preaching in a manner that was uplifting. And a succession of British blunders were now going to take place that exacerbated the situation. Mlanjeni recognized that the ubuti was weak, it had failed. He sought a new explanation, a new power ethos. It came as the Eastern Cape was plunged into one of its regular droughts. Lieutenant Governor and Chief Commissioner George McKinnon wrote about this, saying, The heavens were as iron and the earth as brass. With no instrument of iron could the soil have been dug. The grass for the cattle was burnt up. The rolling green pastures of Xhosaland were parched, and the people sought a saviour as the conditions worsened. Reports about Imlanjeni's powers spread fast, and as they spread, the stories took on the level of myth, as many now believed he was talking to their ancestors. Some thought he was the resurrection of Inglele, the war doctor, who'd almost defeated the British in 1819 in Grahamstown. McLean became alarmed and summoned Umlanjeni's Mhlambi chief Mqai to discuss Umlanjeni. Mqai told McLean not to worry, the boy was part of the Mhlambi, and Mhlambi chief Mhala was one of the most loyal of the British collaborators. Furthermore, Umlanjeni, said Mqai, was merely repeating what the British themselves had been saying, that the witch doctors were bad and that there must be no witchcraft, and the smelling out of witches should be eradicated. McLean did not listen. He sent a detachment of soldiers to order Umlanjeni and his father to appear before him to answer questions. But the boy apparently was too weak to travel, so a police unit instead was sent out to his homestead and destroyed his hut, as well as his all-important two poles, which were burned down. Things degenerated quickly from here on in. Umlanjeni's family hid the youth, and now reports began to circulate that the prophet was everywhere almost at once. McLean found it impossible to capture him, while Umlanjeni's spies were sending information about the movements of the British trying to arrest the prophet. The longer this went on, of course, the more power Umlanjeni appeared to have. His magic was enhanced by the day. He was in the realm of supernaturally powerful, the most dangerous of all opponents to any organized government. He had been anointed as the chosen one by the Amaxhosa people. Millionarianism is a kind of poison that seeps into the consciousness of its believers very, very quickly. It combines a messianic message with a supernatural capacity that appears to be infused into its normally charismatic leader itself. Umlanjeni initially spoke of internal change. He was not an immediate threat to the British. While he spoke about the Amaxhosa healing themselves, McLean misread the situation, and his blunt actions turned Umlanjeni into a symbol of opposition to the British. 2020 hindsight is all very well, you'll say, in that the Amaxhosa were inevitably going to fight the British anyway. However, historians agree that the somewhat blunt approach by McLean hastened the coming war. After being hunted for a few weeks, Umlanjeni's message altered, as you can well imagine, and he began to convey a new story for his rapidly growing following. "Hitherto I have been breaking up ground. Now I shall begin to sow." He wanted the Amaxhosa to kill all the dun-coloured cattle, because, he said, these were cursed, just like the British were accursed. It was his next act that scared the British authorities, for he began to call up Amaxhosa warriors for battle against the invaders, and then extended this to a call to all black people across the Cape Colony. The war doctor dreamed up a complex technique of self-defense, which these warriors were going to deploy to turn bullets into water, and it involved cutting short sticks from the pelargonium plant, geraniums, with which the warriors would then rub their bodies, deflecting the bullets. They would carry these little sticks into battle, and when faced by the British, they were to chew on the sticks, then spit out the mixture and call on their ancestors, as well as call on him, Prophet Umlanjeni, to bless them, to save them, to protect them. The use of this method of chewing on a stick and spitting out the contents was an ancient San and Khoi Khoi custom. This is a direct combination of Christian messaging and animist propositioning. And like the present stampede of apparently 21st century Americans into the arms of the right-wing Taliban in America, aka Christian nationalists, the Amaxhosa stampeded across the Cape into the arms of this millenarianist movement, brandishing their little geranium sticks like evangelicals brandishing their New Testaments. The response was, in Noel Mostat's words, sensational. Umlanjeni's exploits swirled about the colony, and in Cape Town, servants abandoned their employees and headed northwest to Umlanjeni. Missionaries found their congregations withdrawing, with John Ross reporting, "The withdrawal from the house of God is nearly total." The word about Umlanjeni had spread east as well, across the Kai River to the Tlaleka Paramount Chief Sarili, where his people also took up the call of the supernatural. Trekboers living across the region were now told by the Amakhosa workers to leave. There was a closer bond between the early Afrikaner here and the Amakhosa. Their employees were trying to save their lives. War was coming. Bizarre, this history business, is it not? And Nhlambe Chief Sandile, who had been treated so badly by the British, now threw in his lot with Umlanjeni. Lieutenant Governor George McKinnon realized that the actions of his countrymen had exacerbated the situation, so he said not to send any more units to try and capture the prophet, because he recognized that each failed attempt was turning the man into some kind of superhero. It was too late. Patu of the Qunuqwebe sent a message to McKinnon saying that Sandile was planning a war. A spy sent by McKinnon returned with news that Sandile was indeed calling his people to rise up, saying, "Arise, clans of the Khoza nation, the white man has wearied us, let us fight for our country." Sandile had told Amakhosa chiefs that their land was dotted with surveyors' flags to be owned by settlers, and that he wanted to die in war fighting for this land. At Fort Cox, at the bottom of the Amatola Mountains, John Brownlee thought all of this talk of war was exaggerated. Sandile, he said, was just a sore loser, and his people thought he's weak. He was just trying to make a noise for his own pusillanimous and indolent disposition. By early October, however, the messianic noise was deafening, and McKinnon set up a meeting with the Amakhosa chiefs. Sandile, Makoma, Anta, Koko attended, along with all other major chiefs and over 150 of their senior councillors. They sat together on October 5, 1850, as McKinnon warned that any war would lead to all being stripped of what land remained. In Cape Town, Harry Smith had first agreed with Brownlee and had been told that the Amakhosa were more afraid of the British overrunning them than the reverse. "The Khoza appear to have been in as great a state of terror as the colonists," he said, which was true. Both sides were so far apart that all they could see through their monocultural binoculars was the dust of disquiet. Smith's words of comfort did not comfort the colonists, who began fleeing their homes in October, and Harry Smith recognized the crisis was at hand. So he left Cape Town for the frontier on the 15th of October, 1850. It was a relatively quick trip in 1850 because Smith traveled by steamship to East London. 3 days later, he was at the new port, and he leapt on his horse and travelled the short distance to King Williamstown. This meant passing through the lands of Pato's Qunuqwebe and Mhala's Amamhlambe, and Smith noted that the folks he rode past appeared in high spirits, happy. A spattering of rain had fallen at the end of winter, the first rains in more than 9 months, so the Amakhosa he passed were relieved, but they weren't happy to see him. Pato was neutral. He didn't support Imlanjeni's ravings, and he didn't support Sandile's mutterings about dying in war rather than in peace, but he was vacillating. Imhala was also neutral, so on the short journey to King, Smith saw people who were determined to deflect any suspicion of complicity by flattering the easy-to-flatter governor. After arriving in King Williamstown, Smith called Sandile to a meeting and said that the Amanika chief should travel down from his Amatola fastnesses along with Makoma to hear what the British governor had to say. Instead, Sandile sent a messenger with a note claiming he'd fallen off his horse and he was too injured to travel. Makoma simply didn't pitch. No other Amanika chief of significance cared to attend Smith's meeting, which took place on the 26th of October. Sandile had told Brownlee in a moment of candor that he preferred not to travel to meet Smith because the last time he'd been called to a meeting like this, at the end of the War of the Axe, the British had thrown him in jail. I mentioned back in the episode about this incident that Sandile would never trust the British again, and here was proof. Harry Smith threw a fit. On the 30th of October, he summarily announced that Sandile had been deposed as chief of the Amanika people and Charles Brownlee was appointed to succeed him. It was the time of the British Empire, and no half-clothed savage thought Smith was going to reject his orders. What recklessness lay in the heart of these Europeans. These men had no understanding of the human condition. They appear to make thoughtless decisions a habit. Here were the most militant Amakhosa, the most traditional of the people, the Amanika, being ordered around by the most flamboyant and egotistical of the empire's militarists. It was a match made in hell. But Smith was not alone. MacKinnon and MacLean applauded this act while failing to appreciate how suicidal it was, how tone-deaf. They had managed to deprive themselves of the only leverage they had over the Amakosa, through their chiefs. Andri Stockenstrom, sitting in his home close to the Amatola Mountains, would have shaken his head, having told Smith and Colonial Secretary Earl Grey that the only way to the Amakosa heart was through their chiefs. Brownlee was not immune from this lunacy, despite being steeped in Amakosa tradition, fluent in Xhosa, having grown up amongst the Amakosa people. Instead of trying to talk Smith out of firing Sandile as chief of his own people, he called a meeting of all the Amangeka chiefs on the 2nd of November 1850 and read Smith's proclamation word for word. 350 high-ranking councillors were present, and it's safe to say they were shocked. Brownlee completely missed the signs that they were shaken and declared the councillors were now in a state of perfect tranquility in his report later. Smith wrote to Earl Grey, saying that everything was in a state of perfect tranquility, and returned to Cape Town on his steamship on the 8th of November. As soon as he'd left, warriors of the Amangeka seized cattle that Brownlee had impounded for trespassing around the ex-English soldiers' villages along the Tumi Valley near Fort Hare. Shortly after this, Makoma left his kraal near the fort and joined Sandile in the Amatola Mountains. There was a great meeting of the Amangeka chiefs there, attended by Stokwe, chief of the Amambalu, and Sandile, and Makoma. Sandile had visited Imlanjeni earlier, and cattle began to be cooked in the usual sacrificial fires before war. Brownlee, MacKinnon, and MacLean had no idea what was going on. They were listening to the neutral chiefs of the Amanhlambi and the Amakunukwebe, and as usual failed to understand the nuance of African culture. Partu, it was known, hated the Amangeka more than the British. If there was war, he said 1,400 of his warriors would join the empire. Because his territory lay along the strategic route between East London and King Williamstown, the British were being lulled into a false sense of security. Technically, Sandile could call on 35,000 warriors. Behind the scenes at this moment, it was all cloak and dagger. A minor chief called Tuyise, who was a cousin of Amhala, the principal Amanhlambe chief, was deployed as a spy inside the Amangeka. Anta, who was Sandile's younger brother, heard about this, and instead of killing Toyise, gave locals instructions in his words to fool Toyise's ears with news. A disinformation campaign had started. Toyise reported back to MacLean that the Amangeka were planning to start the war by sending their cattle to the side of the Tumi Valley, where Harry Smith's military veterans lived. I spoke about these veterans who were placed on the river as a buffer against the Amakosa, and who, as vets, were supposed to offer some protection against a possible warrior rampage. But I also mentioned that they were often absent from their farms, preferring the delights of local villages and towns to isolated life on the farm. Imhala, the other neutral, a fierce man, a fierce warrior, who disliked the British intensely, was a shrewd political operator. His countryside was open. It was easily overcome by a large force of English soldiers. He was vulnerable and couldn't be as rebellious as Sandile in his mountain fastness. Imhala didn't pitch at Sandile's great meeting in November, but by early December was starting to have second thoughts. Imhala wanted to see how things developed before he joined one or either side. Back in Cape Town, Harry Smith had an epiphany. It suddenly dawned on him that there's never smoke without fire. He became suspicious of the repeated reports of tranquility and set off for East London, arriving in early December with British reinforcements. At about the same time, Amakosa's servants were streaming out of the Cape Colony into Sandile's region, heeding the prophet Umlanjeni's call. Many didn't even bother to collect their wages before they left. They were so sure that salvation was at hand. And as they journeyed east, the settlers began to journey west. They passed each other along the Eastern Cape trails, and by the first week of December, Robert Godlinton's Grahamstown Journal reported, "For a line of 50 miles, nothing is seen but a moving mass of farmers with their wagons, horses, cattle, and sheep, all fleeing from impending destruction." It was the biggest movement of wagons since the Great Trek. The Boers and some of the English preferred to lager together, wagons and stock prepared, gunpowder readied, food stored, earthworks built, farmhouses fortified. There were no black servants leading the trek. The oxen were led by women and children. Dust swirled along these trails once more, interlaced with the sound of the felt and the faces of fear. Behind them, orchards were thick with hanging fruit. It was harvesting time, crops of mealies left ripe and ready. What happened next is for episode 180. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog where you can register for my newsletter, and I have little updates there about episodes. You can also email me from there. Until next, goodbye.